Imagine building this completely groundbreaking product, lining up $3 million in eager investment, and then losing your entire company over a single stray tweet.
Yeah, that is a literal nightmare scenario.
Right.
Yeah.
Or imagine finding out during some critical legal audit that you don't actually own the code to your own software. You know, you've poured your life into this startup.
Oh, absolutely.
You have the prototype, you have these passionate early users, and now you need capital to scale. So you step out into the startup ecosystem, and literally everyone offers you the exact same boilerplate advice.
Let me guess. Just incorporate as a Delaware C-Corp and raise a safe.
Exactly. Just do a Delaware C-Corp and a safe. And I mean, it sounds straightforward, right? But the reality is, executing that advice incorrectly is basically a graveyard for early stage companies.
Oh, without a doubt. The mechanics of that advice are just, they're often completely misunderstood by first-time founders.
Mm-hmm.
People treat the whole Delaware C-Corp and a safe route like it's this magic spell, you know, like it automatically unlocks venture capital.
Like a cheat code or something.
Exactly. But in reality, it is a highly precise legal and financial operation. And doing it wrong doesn't just delay your fundraise. It fundamentally breaks the architecture of your business.
Which is why today's deep dive is entirely focused on this comprehensive, just incredibly practical playbook published by the American newspaper and American TV.
It's such a good resource.
It really is. It serves as this step-by-step roadmap for navigating the actual realities of Delaware C Corp startup fundraising.
And our mission here is to distill that playbook so you, the listener, understand the actual mechanisms of making your company investor ready.
Right, the real nuts and bolts.
Yeah, we are going to look under the hood. From the kind of unsexy legal prep work to the underlying psychology of how investors actually evaluate risk.
All the way up to those strict federal securities laws that can just completely unravel your operation if you aren't careful.
Especially those.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because before we get into the psychology of, you know, asking an investor for a massive check, we really need to examine the vehicle that is actually receiving that money.
The corporate entity itself.
Exactly. Why does the venture capital world universally insist on Delaware?
Well, it fundamentally comes down to friction reduction and predictability. I mean, a Delaware incorporation doesn't magically make a bad business idea valuable, obviously.
Right. It doesn't fix a bad product.
Exactly. What it does is provide a standardized legal operating system for venture-backed companies in the U.S.
An operating system. I like that.
Yeah, because Delaware's corporate case law is arguably the most developed in the world. So when an investor's legal counsel looks at a Delaware C Corp, they already know exactly how the underlying machinery works.
And the playbook highlights that this specific operating system offers a really highly scalable equity architecture.
It does.
It cleanly separates common stock, which is what the founders and employees hold, from preferred stock, which is what the investors buy.
Right. And it establishes very clear board-centric governance rules.
Yeah. And it's totally compatible with future exit pathways, too, whether that's an M&A acquisition or eventually an IPO.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, the real power of Delaware is the massive network effect.
Oh, for sure.
The entire venture ecosystem, I mean, law firms, VC funds, cap tables, software platforms, they are all pre-built around the Delaware model.
So if you go rogue and incorporate in like some other state with bespoke, customized corporate governance rules.
Oh, it's a mess. Because then an investor has to pay their own lawyers hundreds of dollars an hour just to read and interpret your unique documents.
Just to figure out what you built.
Exactly. By using Delaware, you strip away that negotiation friction. Everyone already speaks the language.
It kind of makes me think of opening a restaurant. You know, having a Delaware C Corp is basically like installing a standardized commercial-grade kitchen.
No, I like that analogy.
Right. Having that specific kitchen makes it incredibly easy for a Michelin star chef, who is the investor in this case, to just walk in, know where all the tools are, and get straight to work with you.
Yep.
But simply having a top-of-the-line oven doesn't mean you have a successful restaurant. I mean, you still have to prove you have an incredible recipe.
Exactly. That's a perfect way to look at it. A standardized kitchen removes the excuses, but it does not create the traction.
Right.
No investor is going to fund a company just because the paperwork is filed correctly in Delaware. They're funding a milestone plan.
They want to see the future.
They want to see exactly how a specific injection of capital is going to generate a specific outsized increase in the enterprise value of the company over a defined timeline.
So you've built this standardized commercial kitchen in Delaware. The structure is totally sound. But before you invite those food critics inside for a tasting, what does the actual prep work look like?
Well, it's a lot.
Because the playbook details this pre-fundraising corporate readiness checklist, and honestly, it does not sound like a quick weekend project.
No, it's an intense audit of your foundational legal hygiene. Investors expect absolute clarity before they wire a single dollar.
Understandably.
And that begins with a flawlessly clean cap table.
Basically, the DNA blueprint of who owns what percentage of the company, right?
Exactly. And the playbook stresses that it must be fully diluted.
Okay, meaning what exactly?
That means it can't just show the current founder shares. It must account for every hypothetical claim on equity.
Oh, so all the employee grants, any past IOUs.
Yep, and the full pool of options set aside for future hires.
Yeah.
Ambiguity on the cap table kills deals instantly.
Yeah, I can see why. Now, another deal killer the playbook spends a lot of time on is intellectual property, or IP assignment.
This is a huge one.
It states that every single founder, contractor, and early employee who has ever touched the product must have signed a formal IP assignment agreement.
The mechanism behind this is just vital to understand. Because under copyright law, the person who writes the code or designs the logo owns it by default.
Wait, really? Even if you paid them?
Even if you paid them, unless they explicitly sign those rights over to the company.
Wow.
So imagine an investor is running due diligence, right? They're ready to write a massive check, and their lawyers discover that your lead developer, who was technically a contractor, never signed an IP agreement.
So legally, your startup doesn't even own its own core product.
Exactly. And to an investor, that isn't just a red flag, that is a toxic asset.
Man, that's terrifying. And then, of course, there's basic operational hygiene. Setting up a dedicated employer identification number, opening a proper corporate bank account, and ensuring absolutely zero commingled funds.
Right, no paying for personal groceries out of the startup account.
And no covering server costs from your personal checking account without strict reimbursement records either.
Exactly, keep it clean.
But looking at this readiness checklist, I actually have to push back on one specific warning. The playbook lists fully vested founder equity as a major red flag.
Yep, it does.
But if I am the founder, and I literally birthed this concept out of thin air, why is it a red flag for me to own 100% of my stock outright on day one? Doesn't the founder own the company?
What's fascinating here is how investors calculate key person risk. You are entirely correct that you built the initial foundation,
Right.
but venture capital is not a reward for past behavior. It is a massive bet on future execution.
Okay.
So suppose you hold 100% of your equity, fully vested, on day one, and you raise $3 million, and then on day two, you decide the stress is just too much and you walk away.
Ah, I see. I walk away with a huge percentage of the company already locked in, but I'm doing absolutely none of the grueling work required over the next 5 years to actually make the investors their money back.
Exactly the problem. The company is functionally dead at that point.
Because I took all the equity.
Yeah, you have dead equity sitting heavily on the cap table, making it impossible to incentivize a new CEO to come in and save the business.
Wow.
That is the fundamental reason founder vesting exists. It aligns long-term incentives.
It's protective.
Highly protective. A standard structure is typically a four-year vesting schedule with a one-year cliff. It protects the startup, it protects co-founders from each other, and it assures the investors that you are legally incentivized to stick around and actually execute the milestone plan they're funding.
Okay, that structural protection makes a lot of sense. So you have a flawless cap table, your IP is legally locked down, and your founders are on a vesting schedule. The corporate house is in perfect order.
You're ready for the money.
Right. But when it comes to actually receiving that money, the playbook presents this whole menu of financial instruments.
Yeah.
And choosing the wrong one can apparently be disastrous.
Oh, it can drastically alter the future ownership of the company. The instrument you select has to precisely match the stage of your business and the risk profile of the round.
Right. And the playbook highlights three primary vehicles, right? SAFEs, convertible notes, and priced equity rounds.
Yep, those are the big three.
Let's start with the SAFE, the simple agreement for future equity. According to the playbook, these are basically the go-to instruments for pre-seed or seed rounds where speed is the top priority.
That's right.
They don't have maturity dates and they don't accrue interest.
Yeah, the SAFE was actually engineered by Y Combinator to bypass this impossible task of valuing a company that might only be like 3 months old.
Because how do you value that?
Exactly. Instead of trying to guess what a pre-revenue startup is worth today, a SAFE defers the valuation entirely.
Oh, interesting.
It allows the founder to take the money immediately, get back to building the product, and let a future larger investor set the actual price of the company later on.
I like to think of a safe as putting a massive down payment on a custom house before the architect has even finished the blueprints, and way before an appraiser has told you what the property is worth.
That's a great way to picture it.
You're basically giving the investor a fast pass or an IOU for future shares. But the playbook flashes a massive warning light here.
The dilution trap.
Exactly. If you hand out too many of these IOUs without mathematically modeling the valuation cap and the discount mechanics, you might experience massive hidden dilution when those IOUs finally convert during a priced round.
This is the hidden trap of early fundraising. A valuation cap is essentially a ceiling, right? It sets the maximum price at which that early investor's money will convert into actual shares.
Okay, give me an example.
Let's look at the math. Suppose you issue a safe with a $5 million valuation cap. You take that money, you build an incredible product, and a year later, you raise a massive Series A round that values your company at $20 million.
So the new investors are buying in at a $20 million price tag.
Right.
But the early investors get to convert their IOUs as if the company was only worth 5 million.
Exactly. Because of that cap, the early investors get a massive multiplier on their purchasing power. They get significantly more shares for their initial dollar than the new investors do.
Oh, wow.
And if a founder stacks multiple safes with low caps and steep conversion discounts, the math just compounds. When the priced round finally triggers the conversion of all those IOUs, founders often discover that those early checks have eaten up half their ownership from the inside out.
That is absolutely terrifying if you haven't modeled it out in a spreadsheet beforehand.
Always model it out.
Now, the next instrument on the menu is the convertible note. It operates somewhat similarly to a safe by deferring the valuation, but it functions legally as debt, right?
Yes, very different legally.
It carries an interest rate and a strict maturity date.
And because a convertible note is structured as debt, that maturity date acts as a ticking clock. If a startup reaches that date and hasn't raised a qualifying equity round to trigger the conversion, the investors possess the legal right to demand their money back.
And if the startup doesn't have the cash?
Then it can be forced into default.
Yikes.
Yeah. It creates immense disciplinary pressure on the founder to hit their milestones fast, which is why notes are often best for short-term bridge rounds between major fundraisers.
Okay, that makes sense. Then you have the priced equity rounds. This is usually the territory of a Series A or like a massive institutional seed round.
Right, the big leagues.
This is where all those deferrals end. You set a concrete negotiated valuation for the entire company. You issue actual preferred stock, and you establish formal board seats and governance rights.
And when you step into the realm of priced rounds, the investor psychology shifts heavily toward risk allocation.
Less about speed, more about protection.
Exactly. They care less about the label of the instrument at this point and more about scrutinizing downside protection. They negotiate for things like liquidation preferences.
Which is what, exactly?
It's a legal mechanism guaranteeing that if the startup is sold or goes bankrupt, the investors get their initial capital paid back before the founders see a single dime.
Ah, okay. The playbook also lists pro rata rights and MFN clauses as key negotiated terms here. When we talk about pro rata, we are essentially talking about an investor securing the right to call shotgun on future rounds, right?
That is a perfect visualization. If an early venture fund buys 10% of your company and 2 years later you issue millions of new shares to raise a Series B, that early fund's ownership percentage naturally shrinks.
Right, it gets diluted.
Exactly. A pro rata right gives them the legal option to purchase new shares in that subsequent round, allowing them to maintain their 10% slice of the pie as the company grows.
Got it. And the MFN.
An MFN, or Most Favored Nation clause, is essentially an upgrade guarantee. It states that if you give a later investor a better deal or more favorable terms, the original investor automatically gets those upgraded terms as well.
Okay, so we have a pretty deep understanding of the legal foundation and the financial instruments. We know the math of dilution. But how do we actually convince the investor to sign those documents in the first place?
That's the real challenge.
What are they hunting for during due diligence? What's the psychology behind their evaluation?
Well, you have to remember, venture capital is governed by power laws.
Right.
One wildly successful company in a portfolio has to pay for the nine other startups that completely fail. Therefore, investors evaluate a business by triangulating narrative, evidence, economics, and risk.
That's a high bar.
They need a logical story backed by undeniable market data, driven by a financial model that can logically scale to a massive outcome.
And that requirement for a massive outcome brings us to market sizing.
Mm-hmm.
Investors demand to see a huge TAM, SAM, and SOM, right?
Yeah.
Total addressable market, serviceable available market, and serviceable obtainable market.
They want a huge market.
They aren't looking for a vitamin, they want a painkiller. They want an urgent, incredibly costly problem paired with a highly differentiated solution, not just some minor feature tweak that a massive incumbent competitor could just, you know, assign five engineers to copy over a long weekend.
Exactly. And traction is the only way to prove that differentiation. But traction has to be real evidence.
What counts as real evidence?
That means growing revenue, highly engaged daily active users, or legally binding letters of intent from enterprise clients. It does not mean vanity metrics.
Oh, right.
Tens of thousands of passive followers on a social media page might look impressive, but social clout doesn't pay for server costs, and investors heavily discount it.
They also dig ruthlessly into unit economics, don't they? You can't just grow. You have to grow sustainably.
Sustainable growth is everything.
And that involves the strict ratio between CAC, customer acquisition cost, and LTV, lifetime value.
Because the math of CAC and LTV dictates whether a business actually survives. If you have to spend $100 in marketing and sales to acquire a single customer, but that customer only generates $50 of revenue before churning,
then your startup is just a machine that burns money.
Precisely. Investors track those ratios obsessively alongside your gross margins and strict tracking of your monthly burn and runway to calculate exactly how many months you have left before the lights go out.
Here's where it gets really interesting. With all this emphasis on massive outcomes and massive markets, the playbook specifically warns founders that pitching a large abstract market is actually a weak signal that turns investors off.
Yeah.
Which feels entirely paradoxical. Don't venture capitalists want you to conquer a multi-billion dollar industry?
They absolutely want the multi-billion dollar outcome, but they also know that a startup with limited resources cannot boil the ocean on day one.
Right. You can't sell to everyone at once.
Exactly. If a founder pitches a massive abstract market without a razor-sharp entry strategy, it just signals a lack of strategic focus.
Hmm.
You overcome this trap by defining a highly specific beachhead customer.
Meaning you find a tiny, highly motivated niche where you have an unfair advantage. You completely dominate that specific segment and then use that momentum to expand outward.
Prove you have an unfair advantage and a clear wedge for a focus segment first. And this level of focus also has to reflect in your use of funds documentation.
Oh.
You cannot show an investor a generic pie chart that simply says, we'll spend 50% on marketing and 50% on engineering.
They want specifics.
Every dollar raised must be tied to specific, measurable milestones that you will achieve to unlock the next stage of growth.
Okay, so you have your metrics dialed in, your unit economics makes sense, your beachhead customer is defined, and your milestones are mapped.
You're ready.
Now, you actually have to step into the arena and run the gauntlet. How do you execute the raise? Because the playbook outlines an aggressive, highly structured operating system for this, the 90-day process.
Well, time is the enemy of all deals.
Always.
If a fundraise drags on indefinitely, the market assumes no one wants to invest and the momentum dies. The 30-60-90-day plan forces the founder to control the timeline.
Break that down for us.
Days 1 through 30 are purely for internal preparation. You do not pitch a single investor. You build your data room, you refine your pitch deck, and you draft your memos.
Then, days 31 through 60 are the offensive push, right?
Yeah.
You execute targeted outreach and take meetings in highly coordinated waves.
Yeah, to create a sense of competitive scarcity.
Right. And finally, days 61 through 90 are fiercely protected to negotiate term sheets, complete legal due diligence, and close the capital cleanly.
And the tools required for this sprint must be optimized for short attention spans. A tight pitch deck should be 12 to 13 slides maximum. It is an appetizer, not a textbook.
Keep Benji.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You accompany that with an executive summary, which is a concise two-page narrative, not a dense business plan, and an investor memo.
The investor memo is fascinating to me.
It's a brilliant tool. It's basically the founder-controlled investment case that champions the thesis, the evidence, and preemptively addresses the risks.
It strikes me that the investor memo is basically arming a junior VC associate with the exact arguments they need to defend your startup when they pitch it to the senior partners behind closed doors.
That's exactly what it's doing.
And to manage all of this, the playbook mandates an investor CRM, right? A founder must track every intro source, log the specific objections from every meeting, and define clear next steps for every single interaction.
Because fundraising is not a casual networking event. It is a high-stakes enterprise sales pipeline.
Right.
If you don't track the follow-ups meticulously in CRM, you fall victim to silent deal drift.
Oof, silent deal drift. That sounds painful.
It is the agonizing phenomenon where investors don't actually say no. They just slowly stop replying to emails until the deal dies in limbo. A CRM prevents that. It forces the founder to push for a definitive yes or a definitive no.
Okay, so the momentum is building, your CRM is packed, and tone sheets are floating around. But here's the most terrifying section of the playbook.
The legal guardrails.
Exactly. This is where a simple mistake made with completely innocent intentions can literally attract the attention of federal regulators and unravel the whole company. We have to talk about U.S. securities law.
This is the ultimate guardrail. When a startup sells safes, convertible notes, or stock to an investor in exchange for capital, they are selling securities.
Right.
That means you're operating directly under the jurisdiction of federal securities law. You cannot improvise this.
Startups obviously don't go through the grueling process of a full public IPO just to raise a seed round, though. They rely on specific federal exemptions to sell these securities legally. And the playbook highlights two main pathways, Regulation D, Rule 506B, and Rule 506C.
Yes. So under Rule 506B, a startup is allowed to raise an unlimited amount of money from an unlimited number of wealthy, accredited investors, plus up to 35 sophisticated, non-accredited investors.
That's just great.
It is the most common exemption used. But it comes with a massive, uncompromising restriction. It strictly prohibits any form of general solicitation.
Which means you cannot publicly advertise that you are raising money.
Correct.
But then there was Rule 506C. Now, this exemption does allow for general solicitation, right? You can shout from the rooftops that you are raising capital.
You can, but the catch is incredibly severe. Under 506C, sales must be only to verified accredited investors, and the legal burden falls entirely on the startup to formally verify that wealthy status. And generally, you have to file a Form D notice within 15 days of the first sale.
Okay, wait, let me ask a highly practical question about this line between the two rules. If I am running a quiet fundraise under 506B, relying on private intros where I don't have to verify everyone's tax returns, and I go on a startup podcast to talk about my product, or I just post a thread on social media announcing my company is currently looking for investors, could I accidentally blow my 506B exemption?
This raises an important question, and the answer is a resounding, dangerous yes.
Wow.
A stray tweet, an offhand comment on a public stage at a pitch event, or even putting a small Invest in Us banner on your company's website can absolutely be construed as general solicitation.
Just from a tweet?
Yes. And if regulators determine you cross that line, your 506B exemption is gone. You are immediately forced to comply with 506C.
And why is being forced into the 506C bucket such a disaster for momentum?
Because the administrative burden of legally verifying wealth is massive, and it's incredibly awkward. Under 506C, you can't just have an investor check a box claiming they're wealthy.
Right.
You, the founder, have to take reasonable steps to formally prove it. That means you have to look an angel investor in the eye and ask them to hand over their personal tax returns or get a signed letter from their CPA analyzing their private brokerage statements.
Oh, man. I imagine a lot of wealthy investors will simply walk away from a deal rather than hand over their private financial records to some 24-year-old startup founder.
Exactly. It introduces massive friction and it kills deals.
That is a staggering operational risk attached to a single tweet.
Mm-hmm.
If you are listening to this and gearing up for a raise, let this be your ultimate warning. Always consult U.S. Startup Council before publicly talking about your fundraise.
Yeah, the legal and financial stakes are simply too high to rely on guesswork.
So, to summarize this incredibly rigorous playbook, the most fundable Delaware C-Corp is not the one with the thickest stack of complex, you know, highly customized legal paperwork.
None at all.
In fact, it is the one with a clean, standardized legal structure, a highly credible market thesis, disciplined capital use, legally controlled communications, and a founder who runs a time-boxed, momentum-driven process.
By removing the structural and legal friction, you just ensure that the true value of your milestone plan can actually shine through the intense scrutiny of due diligence.
So what does this all mean? It means preparation is your ultimate leverage in fundraising. You buy leverage with readiness. When you step into that pitch meeting, your cap table is immaculate, your IP is locked down, your dilution math is modeled, and your milestone plan is bulletproof. But I want to leave you with a final provocative thought. The entire strategy outlined in this playbook hinges on having a perfect milestone plan tying every single dollar you raise to a specific, mathematically modeled outcome over the next 12 to 18 months. But as you build this company in the real world, how do you plan for the unknown unknowns? When your perfectly modeled financial milestones inevitably collide with unpredictable human behavior, a sudden competitor, or a massive macroeconomic shift, how will you communicate that necessary pivot to the investors you just brought on board? Because surviving the fundraise is only the beginning. Navigating reality with your new financial partners is the real test, something for you to mull over as you build the future.